This podcast is from the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit institution that helps improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. For more RAND analysis, reports, and commentary on issues at the forefront of today's policy debate, visit www.rand.org.
Well, welcome everybody this morning. I'm Dahlia Dasa-Kay, the director of the RAND Center for Middle East Public Policy. Our center is the umbrella within RAND, where we focus on a range of Middle East issues, political, economic, and social. Many of you may know the RAND Corporation is a nonprofit institution that tries to improve decision-making through research and analysis. And in fact, our discussion today and presentation will be very data-driven and RAND-like. We focus on the issues that matter most, not just issues of national security and international affairs, but questions such as health, education, law, business, the environment, and another a whole range of public policy issues. Which brings us to the topic today, which is one of the most pressing issues coming from the Middle East, which is Egypt. I know that President Obama's trip in the Middle East is generating a lot of the press, but Egypt still remains one of the most critical countries in the Arab Spring transitions, and it is quite a complicated place today, and so we are delighted that we have some distinguished panelists who are going to help make sense of it for us. We're going to start this morning with actually one of our top researchers at RAND, Jeff Martini, who has spent considerable amount of time on the ground in Egypt since the revolution there. And he has, in fact, authored a report, which is in front of all of you today, on voting patterns in post-Mubarak Egypt, which will kind of launch our discussion on some of the broader political trends. Then I'm really delighted that we're joined by two very distinguished Egypt watchers, Michelle Dunn of the Atlantic Council, who directs their Harik Refari Center of the Middle East, and is also someone who is very knowledgeable from both inside and outside government. And we have next to Michelle Samir Shahada, a professor at Georgetown University, who is a longtime Egypt watcher, and in fact, I understand, just returned from Egypt earlier this month, or maybe just a week or so ago, and we'll bring some fresh insights from the ground. So I look forward to a very engaging panel discussion. First, we will hear from Jeff on this report, and then we will engage in that panel discussion. Just a few logistical issues. For those of you interested in getting a copy of the report and this panel, which is being filmed, it will be available on our website at www.rand.org. The edited version will be available by next week. This is also being filmed live right now on C-SPAN. You can also get it at our CMEP, our RAND Center for Middle East Public Policy's website, which is www.rand.org/CMEPP. And you can get this report as well as many thousands of other RAND reports on a range of public policy issues. And our congressional staff tells me you can also subscribe to their briefing series, which is podcast on iTunes. We are very ahead of the curve here on social media. So with that, I'd like everybody to please silence your cell phones. And we look forward to having an engaging discussion on a complicated country in the region. And very thank all of you for taking the time to come here this morning. I'm now going to turn it over to Jeff, who will lead our discussion with some insights from his new report just released today. Thank you.
Thanks, Dahlia. So let me begin by thanking everyone for coming. It's a great turnout. We appreciate it. We know everyone's busy. And also thanking Dahlia, whose center funded this. Dahlia personally oversaw the research for this project. And she also twisted my arm into doing this event on the Hill. So thank you, Dahlia. And also to Michelle and Samir, who really are two of the preeminent Egypt watchers and have been really kind to me personally. So I'm going to begin by rolling out the study that was released today, as Dahlia mentioned. And the top line of that study really is that Egypt isn't lost to Islamists, if you will. That, in fact, non-Islamists are increasingly competitive, particularly in certain areas of the country. And should they choose to contest future elections, in fact, they're likely to pick up seats on their Islamist rivals. Before I kind of walk you through that analysis step by step, for those of you who don't follow the situation as closely, maybe some background is in order, which is after the January 25th revolution in 2011 that toppled Hosni Mubarak, There were parliamentary elections, initial parliamentary elections, in late 2011 and early 2012. That resulted in an Islamist-dominated assembly in both, there's two chambers, in the lower house and in the upper house. Subsequently, a court decision dissolved the lower house, and now we were scheduled to have a rerun of elections for the parliament on April 22nd of this year. But again, there's an issue of the constitutionality of the election law. So when we have those elections remains in doubt, and whether the non-Islamist opposition, which is for the most part organized itself under the National Salvation Front, whether they participate remains in doubt. So that's by way of background. But now I want to get to the report. And so the report looks at several questions. What we're trying to answer here is kind of subnational voting patterns. So if you want to take the U.S. metaphor, it's what's the red state, blue state dynamic look like in Egypt? That is, where is the electoral base of Islamists and where is the electoral base of non-Islamists? And so in addition to looking at these subnational voting patterns, we're also looking at broader trend lines. So Egypt has had four major votes during the 2+ years that it's been undergoing its political transition. So there's been two referenda. There was an up or down vote on the interim charter, and there was a vote on the permanent constitution this past December. It had the parliamentary elections, and it had a presidential vote. So only four data points, but still there are some data in which to look at more macro trend lines of, is the political star of Islamists waxing and waning, or non-Islamists, if you want that to be your point of analysis. And then what are the prospects for non-Islamists going forward? Some people have said they're irrelevant to the process. This analysis will argue that they aren't, and in fact, will be increasingly competitive. So once again, in terms of our study approach, our methodology, we're looking at four major votes: the interim constitutional referendum, the election for the parliament that took place in late 2011 and early 2012, the presidential runoff, and the referendum on the permanent constitution. And for those of you who do follow Egypt closely, you'll notice that we're excluding two votes here. That is, the election for the upper house of parliament, and the presidential election was a two-staged election. There was an initial election with five, what I would call first-tier candidates, competed, and then there was a runoff between the two top finishers. We don't look at that early round of the presidential vote, and we don't look at the upper house elections. I can get into that in the Q&A. It's fairly complicated why we didn't do that, but we're focusing on these four votes. So before I actually depict the electoral results graphically, and you can see where the electoral bases are of the different blocks, it's useful to have some understanding of where the electorate is located within Egypt. So for those of you who have visited the country or perhaps hail from there, you'll know that most Egyptians live very close to the banks of the Nile. So you have huge expanses of territory, for example, in the west that are mostly desert areas. You have this area along the Red Sea and the Sinai. Those are big expanses of territory, but they have very little of the electorate. So these areas that are shaded in turquoise and orange, they contain 97% of the electorate. So those are the areas you're going to want to focus on. And in particular, the governorates that are labeled as Upper Egypt, that has a little more than 20% of the vote. The area that's Cairo and its environs, which I'm meaning two governorates, Cairo and Giza governorate. It's a big metropolitan area. That's a little over 20% of the vote. And some of you may not know, the Delta, which is where the Nile River fans out, and there's a lot of second cities there. There's the biggest, there's the largest second city, Alexandria, but Mansoura, Dum and Hur. There's a lot of smaller second cities there. That's actually more than 50% of the electorate. So if you're looking at kind of where's the center of gravity, it's there. So now I want to jump right into, again, these sort of red state, blue state dynamics of where of which where the Islamists have their strongest support base and where non-Islamists have their strongest support base. And I should say, I'm counting Islamists here as both the Freedom and Justice Party, that is the political arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, but also the Salafist groups, which for this election ran under Hizb an-Nur, had a party list, the Noor Party, and the Salafists ran under that party list. And in the aggregate, Islamists counted that way, won 73% of the seats in the lower house. So they really dominated that election. It's hard to say they didn't. Frankly, they cleaned up in that election. And the green areas show where they overperformed their national average, so they won even more than 73% of the seats in these governorates that are shaded in green. In the red, they won less than their national average, so less than 73% of the seats. And the beige-ish areas are where they performed in line with their national average. And so what you'll see is some clear geographic divides. So the Islamists, again, the Freedom and Justice Party and the Salafists, did quite well in Upper Egypt, which you would expect. Non-Islamists did well in larger metropolitan areas in the north, which you would also expect, places like Cairo and Port Said. What is surprising for an Egypt watcher like me, and maybe for Michelle and Samer as well, is that Islamists had some vulnerabilities in the Delta. In fact, the Muslim Brotherhood is an organization I focus on a lot. The Delta was often referred to as the stronghold of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's because Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the organization, founded it in Ismailia. A lot of the early branches were there. And the current leadership of the organization, or some of their more prominent leaders, like Mohammed Badia, who runs the Guidance Bureau, the executive apparatus of the Brotherhood, and Mohammed Morsi, who was the president of the Freedom and Justice Party and is now the president of the country, they both hail from this area. So you do see some vulnerabilities for the Islamists within the Delta that you might not expect. So the next election that followed those that parliamentary vote was the presidential elections. And here, again, I'm focusing on the runoff, where you had the Muslim Brotherhood's candidate, Mohammed Morsi, who was running explicitly on the Brotherhood's platform of renaissance, against Ahmed Shafiq, who really didn't have a platform other than that he was running against the Brotherhood. So you had a very sort of secular, strongly secular figure coming from the military establishment, the last prime minister appointed by Mubarak as a last-ditch attempt to hold on to power, actually served under Mubarak in the Air Force, again, running as a bulwark against the Islamists. And then you had the prototypical kind of Islamist candidate here, and that you had the Brotherhood putting forward their candidate. And what you see is really stark geographic divides. So what you started to see in the parliamentary election is really crystallized here. Mohamed Morsi wins every governorate in Upper Egypt with one exception, the teeny government of Luxor, and there's reasons why that might be exceptional. We could talk about it. But again, you see a lot of vulnerabilities for the Islamists, in this case Mohamed Morsi, in the Delta. Ahmed Shafiq, despite his baggage, wins five governorates in the Delta, including Mohamed Morsi beat him in his home governorate of a Sharqiya governorate, where Morsi represented that governorate as a parliamentarian in the 2000 to 2005 period. And in fact, Ahmed Shafiq won by pretty big margins in the Delta, by more than 10 percentage points in four of those five governorates. More secular candidates or non-Islamists also tend to do well in the Red Sea area in the South Sinai. But again, I don't want to concentrate on those because it's a teeny share of the electorate. We're talking about less than 1%. But the storyline that's emerging from these votes is Islamists are doing very well in Upper Egypt. Non-Islamists are doing well in the metropolitan areas in the north, Cairo, Port Said, to an extent, Alexandria. And there's really some surprising opposition to the Islamists, in my mind, that's emerging in the Delta. Now, I'm going to move on to the constitutional referenda. And the reason why I didn't lead with this, it's the first chronologically. This was the first vote that took place after the revolution. But I think we should look at it with some degree of caution in terms of what it says about support for Islamists and non-Islamists, and that they weren't on the ballot. This was an up or down vote on the framework for the transition period. That said, it's a decent proxy indicator because Islamists strongly lined up in favor of the charter, and most non-Islamists opposed the charter. So you can view it as somewhat of a proxy indicator. And what you see here is the Islamist position, you know, the interim charter, there was a yes vote of 77%. So if that's the Islamist position, it's really their high watermark. And it's the first vote after the transition. And you see this, despite the fact that there's wide support for this, for the interim charter that extends throughout the country. For example, the charter passed by no less than 61% in all of, at that time there was 29 governance, now there's 27, in all of the 29 governance of Egypt, you do still see these geographic divides. So it passed by the largest margins in Upper Egypt, just as we saw in the earlier votes, that's why they're shaded green. And where there was pockets of opposition, they were in the same areas, Giza, Cairo, Alexandria, and these smaller or sparsely populated governance of South Sinai and the Red Sea. Now I'm going to move on to the most recent vote in Egypt, which was the December 2012 referendum on the Constitution. And here, again, as when we compared the parliamentary vote with the presidential vote, the regional divides are even more stark. So what we see here is you had three governance in the Delta, or you had two governance in the Delta in Cairo that majorities rejected the Constitution. It only passed by a percentage point in Port Said. Also, overall support dropped. So whereas for the interim charter, that passed with 77% of the vote, here you only have 64% yes, and you have a significant drop in turnout, a 13% drop in turnout. Only a third of the electorate turned out to vote for the permanent constitution. So what are the main takeaways? The main takeaways are that Islamists do quite well in Upper Egypt, in the outlying governance of the West, whereas and also in North Sinai, whereas non-Islamists do well in Cairo and its immediate environs, South Sinai, and those sparsely populated governance on the Red Sea. So that speaks to the main takeaways in terms of the red state, blue state dynamic, if you will, of Egypt. The Delta is contested territory, and to me, surprisingly so. We see an opportunity, if you will, for non-Islamists. Islamists perform well in the Delta in absolute terms, but they underperform their national averages. And then there's also a macro trend, which is support for Islamists is waning over time. We see that their high water mark was in the first referendum, the first election that occurred after the transition, at which point they've been bleeding some support. So what are the implications going forward? I'm not here to advocate that the National Salvation Front should participate in the elections. That's their choice, and there's a complicated calculus behind that. And there could be good reasons for not participating, frankly. But my analysis argues that should they decide to participate, they could pick up seats. And again, and I'm not suggesting that they would get a majority of seats. Those groups combined to get a very small percentage in the first parliamentary elections. But I think they would outperform as they did in the 2011-2012 elections and be more competitive. And I think the trend lines that I'm identifying here, I take a study approach that's very data-driven, as Dahlia mentioned. But if you take a more qualitative approach and you look at developments, recent developments in the region, they tend to support these main trend lines. So, for example, you have a lot of opposition that's been galvanized by President Morsi's November 22nd presidential decree, in which he expanded the powers of the executive at that time, in which he placed his decisions above judicial review and also appointed what has been a very divisive prosecutor general, for instance. And that's galvanized a lot of opposition to Morsi himself and to the Brotherhood more writ large. You've had major protests recently in the canal cities, in Ismailia and Port Said and Suez. And those protests don't necessarily have to do with directly with support for Islamists or support for non-Islamists. But they've definitely taken on a political turn and spread more broadly throughout the country. Also, you've had a change in the relative cohesiveness of actors. So one of the advantages of the Islamists in previous elections was they were a pretty cohesive bloc. You've had some splintering among the Salafist groups. So you've had what are sometimes called the doves of the Salafist groups break away from Hizb an-Nur and start Al-Watan, the homeland party. And you've had tensions even within other elements of the Salafist community and between the Salafists and the Muslim Brotherhood. And you've also had recent changes in the electoral formula, which I would argue are going to play to the strength of non-Islamists. So there was a recent decision by the Supreme Constitutional Court which mandated that representation in parliament be proportional to the size of the electorate in that district or governorate. Traditionally, Upper Egypt, those southern governorates, have had disproportionate representation. It was actually a strategy of the previous regime. There's lower political consciousness there. The regime felt like those areas were easier to deliver for the then ruling party, the National Democratic Party. The areas that are going to get seats under the new formula are Cairo, which is going to get a lot of seats, and the Delta. And as this analysis has shown, Cairo is in fact an area where non-Islamists do well, and the Delta is contested territory. So I think there are a lot of trend lines that play in favor of the non-Islamists.
Thank you, Jeff. And what I think what we'll do is we'll broaden, open up the discussion. I'm going to start with some questions for our panelists, and then we'll open it up to the room for questions from you all in a few minutes. So what I'd like to do first is turn to Samer and Michelle to get some reactions to Jeff's report, and then we can broaden a little bit in terms of broader trend lines. And starting with this whole analysis of that Jeff is presenting about the balance of power and the losing influence or declining influence of the Islamists, the fracturing within, and so forth. To what extent, Samer, maybe you can start, do you agree with this analysis of the balance of power internally? And Michelle, you can speak to that as well, but maybe also the question of to what extent these elections play a role, how significant are they compared to other factors in Egypt's political transition, because they're not isolated. So I also want to make sure we think of the broader context here. So let's start with Samer.
Sure. Well, first, you know, I need to commend Jeff and his co-author for the report. It's a very interesting report. It's a very good report. And I think what we should immediately take away is the fact that now, when elections in Egypt actually have some integrity, and the voting patterns mean something, we can empirically study outcomes. And of course, we couldn't do this before, because the primary determinant of election outcomes in Egypt under Mubarak was the extent of electoral fraud. And so for those of us who studied elections, we had to kind of guess which districts the voting had some integrity and which districts didn't. So I think this is one of the first studies I've seen, and hopefully there will be more empirical analysis of voting patterns, of who votes for whom and why and so on. So I think, you know, the authors need to be commended. I agree generally, I think, with some of the conclusions that are drawn from this. The fact that there is a geographical aspect of voting with regard to Islamists, that, and maybe I would phrase it differently, or this is an area of exploration, that urban centers, not just Cairo, but urban centers, Alexandria, which I would think for some reasons should be excluded from the category of the Delta, a city of 5+ million people and so on, that I think voted for Hamdin Sabahi, the socialist candidate, in the first round of the Egyptian parliamentary elections, that urban centers tend to not be so favorable or as favorable to Islamists. And of course, more rural areas tend to be more favorable to Islamists. And in fact, we can maybe even go beyond thinking about geography and thinking about what this means in terms of socioeconomic class. And I think this is very, very important. And I think what we'll find is that, and there has been some research that has been done in a very initial stage to try to document this, I think by the Danish-Egyptian network done by the Ilaharam Center for Political and Strategic Studies, that tries to argue, and this makes sense intuitively, that there is a relationship between wealth, education, and voting, and that in fact the more, the higher socioeconomic classes, the more education, the less likelihood one is to vote for Islamists. And in fact, we could even, and some of the data shows this, that less education, lower wealth, one is more likely to vote for not just Islamists, but the Salafi groups and so on. So I think that's a very, very important, and I think that's in line with the findings and the arguments that are made here. I also think that the other general trend, without overemphasizing it, is also valid, and that is that we are likely to see decreasing electoral strength for Islamists generally. And there are many reasons for that, some quite simple. That is that, you know, up until 2011, up until the Egyptian uprising, Islamist groups, and particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, are really the only serious political actors other than Mubarak's ruling party that actually took elections seriously. And there was good reason for that. If you were a rational voter in Egypt under Mubarak, you stayed home because you knew that your vote didn't mean anything. And I think the large, significant liberal political currents also didn't participate in elections. And many of the parties that we see emerging now, Mohamed al-Bradei's party, the Constitution Party, and others and so on, are new post January 25, 2011 phenomena. So as these liberal secular parties get more established, establish brand names, which they don't have. And this is another issue. The Muslim Brotherhood has a brand name. It's a recognizable commodity. People know what they're voting for when they vote for the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's to some extent true for the Salafis as well. I don't think that can be said for some of the liberal parties. It might be able to be said for the Weft Party, a very old liberal pro-market pre-even Egyptian revolution, 1952 revolution party, but it certainly can't be said of some of the other political, liberal, secular political parties. So as these parties become more established, as they open up offices, as they gain electoral experience, as they hopefully, which they haven't done, do outreach, do community work, have a presence outside the major cities and so on, do the difficult work of political organization, because of course half of political success is organization. And the Islamists have done a wonderful job of this, and the liberal secular parties and those youth that were initiated the revolution have not done a very good job of this. As these groups engage in this kind of grassroots retail politics, I would hope that their electoral fortunes would do better. And I think I'll just end with the following, and that is, initially, and that is there's another reason why Islamists are likely to do less well in the coming, you know, years, and that is because up until the present, Islamists have not been tested. But Mr. Morsi now has been tested, at least since August of 2012, and the situation is not good. And there has been significant economic deterioration. There's rising unemployment, a million people more unemployed. There's a liquidity crisis. There is the withdrawal of foreign direct investment. There is the downgrading of the Egyptian economy by the international rating agencies. There is the depreciation of the Egyptian pound. And there's a serious security issue in the country. And so voters in Egypt, like elsewhere, respond to conditions. And right now, the conditions are, the trend line is not positive. And I think that will likely have some impact on future elections. Not decisive or determinant in the sense that liberals and secular groups are going to win elections, you know, 50% plus one, but I think they're likely to do better. And just the last point that I'll make, and I don't think this comes up in the report, And that is something to think about. I think at one level it's true, but there, you know, the empirics about this need to be investigated a little more thoroughly. To what extent is electoral competition in Egypt for Islamists competition between Islamists as opposed to between Islamists and liberal secular forces? In other words, if you speak to members of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Freedom and Justice Party, as I did last week and as I did in the previous elections and so on, I think that their fears when they look at upcoming elections aren't so much from Mohammed al-Baradei and the Waft Party and Hamdine Sabahi, it's from the right. It's from the Salafi parties, from the Noor Party, and so on. And so what we're likely to see is also a rebalancing, possibly, of that relationship. In the first elections, the parliamentary elections, as Jeff mentioned, the Muslim Brotherhood and their electoral partners received about 43-45% of the vote, whereas the Salafi bloc received about 25% of the vote. It could very well be the case that in the upcoming elections that's rebalanced a bit, and the Salafi parties maybe do a little bit better, and the Muslim Brotherhood, the Freedom and Justice Party, does a little bit less. So I think I'll end there initially and hand things over to Michelle.
Have an agreement on this, and maybe you could speak a little to the strength of the non-Islamist parties and the extent to which they're getting their act together or not. So,
okay, welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Dahlia. Thank you, Jeff. And I agree that I thought the report was excellent, very useful, and the findings certainly ring true in the main. But since I've been asked to comment, I'm going to problematize a little bit. And I would say that I thought the findings were great in the sense that they counter the conventional wisdom, you know, that there's a green wave, that the Brotherhood is it, you know, they've taken over Egypt, there's no going on from this. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I agree with Jeff that isn't necessarily the case, and we need to look in more detail. But I also think, and I understand that with the report you were trying to tell a clear story. But, you know, when we get beyond that, I think look at things in a little more detail, there are a lot of other questions that arise. Now, you know, one of them, Samer just raised one of them, which I think is a very big one, which is that this is a very pluralist scene in Egypt, and it's pluralist on all parts of the political spectrum, including the Islamist part. So to just say Islamist versus secularist really doesn't tell you the whole story. And the Noor Party and the Salafis are a very important part of the story. And in fact, you know, if we could put up here sort of a schematic of the main political parties, right? Already the political scene in Egypt has sorted itself out to some extent, as so often happens after a revolution, right? You have dozens of parties in the first election and fewer in the next and over several terms. So, but now, I mean, we still have at least a dozen political parties, if not more, that are relevant right now. But it's not just Islamists versus secularists. You could also look at them as being right, center, liberal, and left. And you have Islamist right, center, liberal, and left, and secularist right, center, liberal, and left, which tells you, you know, something about the secular versus Islamist, but also the political agenda, the agenda in terms of human rights, and the economic agenda. So, you know, the political spectrum is a lot more complicated, I think, than just Islamist versus secularist. And it would be great, you know, in future work, if you do more work based on this, to look at that sort of thing. I also think very much, you know, I want to emphasize a point that Samer raised about the important role of mobilization, because it's very good that you based your findings on electoral results, not on public opinion. But one could be misled in reading this report and thinking it's all about how people feel about the Brotherhood versus secular parties or something. And as we know, in an electoral democracy, it's really much more about what people do, and especially about who shows up. on Election Day. And that's one caution I want to raise about what the electoral results will be next time. Now, you, of course, raised the important issue of whether the parties that have gathered within the National Salvation Front will participate. That's huge. But let's even say they do participate or whatever. Mobilization is enormous. So the question is, if sentiment is trending against the Brotherhood, and I agree it is. I mean, there are protests against the Brotherhood at the Brotherhood headquarters in Cairo today, and they've been happening. What's more impressive is that they've been happening in a lot of other parts of the country, not just in Cairo, where we already know that sentiment is not particularly pro-Brotherhood. But so I agree with this, and I think I'd be very interested, Jeff, and I'm sure you've looked at the recent student elections, professional syndicate elections. There is a trend of the Brotherhood losing its share, not losing entirely, but losing its share in these elections. And it's interesting to think what this means for parliamentary elections. But my question about parliamentary elections is, if people are feeling down on the Brotherhood, does that mean they're going to turn up and vote for somebody else, or does that mean they're just not going to turn up? And is it still going to be, you know, the Brotherhood and perhaps the Salafis with their mobilizational mechanisms that can get people to turn out and vote for them? So I think that's something that we're going to need to look at. One other question that arose, you raised this question of the Delta, and I'm actually hoping Samer can say a word about this. I'm curious about the role of labor. We haven't really talked about that, but that can be an important factor in the Delta. And whether that's one of the reasons, you know, there are some very strong, obviously, labor cities in the Delta and the Canal area and so forth, and also one of the reasons why in the first round of the presidential elections, Hamdine Sabahi did well. I actually wish, but it would have had to have been a more detailed paper, you were able to get into analyzing the first round of the presidential election. I think it was extremely interesting, although admittedly there were some political factions, notably the liberals, who were not represented in the first round of the presidential election. But when we get into what I was talking about, you've got, you know, right Islamists, left Islamists, right secularists, left secularists. I think if you looked at the first round results of the presidential election, you could begin to see how the electorate divides up in that more differentiated way. The last issue I'll raise is just, you mentioned the electoral districts and this court ruling that the electoral districts have to be more representative in terms of population. There are a lot of accusations now of gerrymandering, that there has been, you know, an effort while Morsi has been in power to break up some of the districts that secularists want. I wonder what you think about that. There's also a big issue with the voter lists. These are all things that are, you know, very complicated technical issues, but we know they can have a profound impact on how parliamentary elections will come out when they eventually take place. I have some things I would like to say about what this means for the United States and U.S. policy toward Egypt, but perhaps shall I save those,
yeah,
Dahlia?
Okay.
Okay, thank you,
Michelle. Well, I think these were great comments and really helpful as we move forward with this line of research. You know, there seems to be agreement that sentiment, voting patterns, as Jeff report shows, is trending against the Muslim Brotherhood. I think the disagreement is what are the implications of that and where will things move going forward. So I wouldn't mind getting both, especially Summer and Jeff's view on what is your view of where things are going in terms of the election boycott and whether that's likely to happen, or how is the National Salvation Front, the non-Islamist groups, looking at these trends? Are they thinking this is an opportunity? Right now they're considering the boycott. Is that a mistake? Where do you think, what are possible scenarios of how this might play out? And then to Michelle, and then then we have time to open up for questions, I would like your assessment, especially since you've spent time in government, of to what extent do you think the U.S. can influence these outcomes? Should we be trying to take advantage of these vulnerabilities that we're seeing on a regional basis, or would that backfire? You know, to what extent should we try to play in this electoral game? and more broadly, you know, what kind of steps this is. We're on the Hill today, and many folks here are thinking about different steps the U.S. can take in terms of reorienting U.S. relations with Egypt. So I think it's very important to open up the discussion in that way as well. So let's start on what are future scenarios that might be possible. We'll start with Jeff and then head back to Samer.
In terms of the election boycott that was announced by the National Salvation Front, I mean, it's hard to tell whether they're going to participate in future elections when these elections eventually do occur. The National Salvation Front has a series of demands. They're pretty far-reaching. One of them is for a national unity government. So Hichem Kandil, he's the current prime minister. He'd have to go, probably. The prosecutor general, Talat Abdallah, he's he's not personally that divisive of a figure. The problem is the way in which he was appointed, which most Egyptians would say is not the appropriate procedure for appointing the prosecutor general. So there's the National Salvation Front has a big list of demands that they would like to see the Brotherhood accede to. The Brotherhood has tried to show that they're flexible on some of them. There's been a lot of press reporting that they're willing to, for example, shuffle the cabinet. They have not yet. But again, going forward, it's very tough to tell. What's also tough to tell is how cohesive the National Salvation Front is. I mean, I've been surprised, and they've exceeded my expectations of their ability to be able to hold together. If there was a main critique of the non-Islamist forces, it's that they're fractious. They don't get along together. The parties are very personalistic. There's a lot of infighting. They were unified in this boycott. They have some really smart people. In fact, their boycott campaign is being organized by Amr Hamzawi, who used to work at Carnegie and is a smart guy and knows what he's doing, is politically astute. But I could see some fracturing. There's certainly some rank and file within some of the parties that would like to contest. The WAFT, the Historic Nationalist Party, is always going to be a problem in this. But they're a group that you could see break for political expediency reasons if they see an opportunity to pick up seats. They've done that in the past. Again, hard to tell how it'll shake out. It's also, you don't know if these demands that the National Salvation Front have made are genuine or if they'll move the goalposts. They have moved the goalposts several times. So even if the Brotherhood is willing to back down, will the NSF just push them, you know, farther, see that it's to their political advantage not to participate? And I'll just close by saying, although my analysis argues that should the National Salvation Front participate, they would pick up seats, I'm not necessarily advocating they take that approach. There's good reasons. They have one source of leverage. They can or cannot legitimize the election. They have one very big bullet in their chamber. How they, you know, decide to use that is up to Mohammed al-Baradei and Amr Hamzawi to figure out. But there are also good reasons for them maybe to withhold participation if they think they can get more out of it. For example, revisiting the Constitution.
Okay, Samer, would you agree? I mean, we mentioned earlier how they're facing, the Islamists face, you know, threats from their right as much as the left. So is this a strategically a mistake by the non-Islamist National Salvation Front to consider this boycott given what may fill the vacuum?
Right. Well, it's not a mistake certainly to consider the boycott, but it has to be said that boycotts are incredibly difficult to sustain and for them to be successful. Boycotts are essentially a collective action problem in reverse. And what this means is that then there are increased incentives, as Jeff mentioned, for defectors, because if you defect and others are not participating, there's a higher likelihood that you're going to succeed and then be represented in greater numbers in any kind of parliament. And Jeff is also very correct in pointing out that we've already seen indications that groups, parties like the WEFT and others, are likely to participate in the election. I think it needs to be also said that the question of boycott was initially put forward when the elections were announced for April, mid, late April, and so on. Now that the administrative court and then likely the Supreme Constitutional Court is going to delay this process because of the constitutionality of the electoral rules, there's no question that the National Salvation Front will revisit this issue. So the first point is that electoral boycotts are very difficult to sustain, and they are very difficult to be successful. And essentially, the goal of this is to deprive the legitimacy that elections provide to the government. Well, that's unlikely to be successful for a number of reasons. As Michelle and Jeff have mentioned, there are many political parties, including other Islamists, not the Muslim Brotherhood, who are going to participate in the elections for certain. And there are other liberal and non-Islamist groups that have already announced they're going to participate, such as Ayman Noor, for example, soft Islamists like Abdul Manan Abul Futuh. It looks as if Anwar Sadat's party, the Reform and Development Party, is going to participate in the elections and so on. So it's unlikely that an election boycott will be successful. Of course, one of the logics of the electoral boycott would be not only to deprive legitimacy to Morsi and the government, but you know, many of the people in the National Salvation Front and liberal and secular voices want Morsi to fail miserably, and they want that things to deteriorate so much in Egypt that Morsi cannot continue as president. And many people are calling for that. Many people are calling for many liberal and secular voices, and I think this is absurd, are calling for Morsi to be removed, are calling for the military to intervene. There are petitions signed by Egyptians asking the Minister of Defense to intervene and to remove Morsi. Others are calling for early presidential elections so Morsi doesn't continue with his 4 years. And even though I think Mr. Morsi's reign has been disastrous in many ways, I think it would be a terribly bad precedent for him not to continue for his 4 years. So I think the question of the boycott will be revisited, and I think that even though the 14 demands of the National Salvation Front are really excessive in many ways, I think that many of the parties that are talking about boycott will eventually participate.
Okay, Michelle, how does the U.S. solve all this? Or deal with it.
First of all, briefly, I never answered your previous question about how significant will the next elections be.
Yeah.
Just a couple sentences on that. I think very significant because of this. The Constitution that was passed in December is vague in many respects, and it's troubling in many respects. And where the country is actually going to go is going to depend very much on legislation that will be passed by this next parliament, especially if it were actually to serve out its full term, that will implement or not implement a lot of things that are in the Constitution. So I think there's a lot at stake. Okay, what about the United States? To what extent can the United States influence incomes, and should it try to do so? Look, clearly, I think it would be a mistake for the United States to try to do that in an open and clumsy way. It can easily backfire. We could all play out those scenarios. But I do think that the United States should be keeping in mind the findings of this report and what it means. I think that U.S. policy toward Egypt needs to have kind of a big picture, a long game, and a short game. The long game is what you're talking about here, that this is a pluralist, dynamic situation in Egypt. The game is on, so to speak, and now is not the moment to say that because Islamists won 3/4 of the parliament in the first elections and Morsi won the presidential elections, that's it. This is an Islamist Egypt, and let's all just reconcile ourselves to that. I think that would be a mistake. I think the United States should interest itself in the long game in the development of a democratic system in Egypt, not in specific political outcomes. And also, frankly, I think the United States should have an interest in the fact that if Egypt is going to succeed in becoming a democracy, that Islamists and secularists in some combination are going to have to work together. There are simply too many Islamists and too many non-Islamists for either group to run the country without the others. And I talked about the differentiated political spectrum, and I think there's a lot of scope for alliances and working together. It's not easy, as we see now. And that brings us to the short game, where Egypt right now, I mean, in the next month or two, is facing really critical economic and security challenges. And we're looking at the real possibility of a breakdown into chaos of some kind, an economic crisis that would have huge political ramifications. And in that, I think the United States has to be playing a role, urging all parties and very much urging President Morsi to compromise politically. I think at this point, President Morsi is trying to proceed in the political transition and run the country basically just with the Brotherhood behind him. Well, as we've seen that by these results, and as is manifestly the case in his inability to address these economic and security challenges, it's not enough for him to just, you know, the Brotherhood cannot run the country on its own. They're going to have more people in their political tent. They're going to have more allies to address these important questions. And therefore, I think also it's a mistake for the United States to treat President Morsi as though he's the new Mubarak. You know, as though now that's it. President Morsi and his small group from within the Brotherhood are going to be in charge of the country for years and decades to come. I think the United States should have in mind that if the democratic system does develop and remains open and elections continue to be free and competitive, that there's likely to be turnover, that people that we see today in the opposition, whether they are secular, whether they are Salafis and so forth, we're likely to see in high government positions in the future, and the United States should be much more serious about the contacts that it has with people in the political opposition. I think the United States has focused all of its efforts in the last year or so on developing good relations with the Brotherhood. Morsi is the legitimately elected president, and of course the United States should try to have constructive relations with him and with others in his government and his advisors. And I speak to them as Samer, and we all do. But it shouldn't be only that. And here I just want to point to the importance, I think, of the United States not throwing its weight behind this candidate or that party, or that would clearly backfire, but standing up for the values that some of these parties that are standing for. I continue to think that liberalism is very, very vital in Egypt. It's alive. It's growing in some ways. I just published an article in the Journal of Democracy about this, why liberalism still matters in Egypt. I think the United States needs to be standing up particularly for freedom of expression and freedom of association, for the role that the media and civil society organizations, as well as political parties, can play as watchdogs and so forth, keeping this political scene open so that the rights of Egyptians are protected no matter who wins elections, and so that Egyptians can have a real ability, a real right and ability to change their government through elections, to call the government to account, and if they're unhappy, to vote someone else in.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm going to open it up to the floor.
This presentation is provided as a public service by the RAND Corporation. Visit www.rand.org to learn more about these issues and to explore RAND's free online library of more than 10,000 policy reports and commentaries.